Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. Today we have with us labor journalist Sarah Jaffe. Sarah has two books out, Necessary Trouble and Work Won't Love You Back, and a third, From the Ashes, coming out in September of this year. All of them are published through Hachette imprint Bold Type Books. Her second book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone, takes a deep dive into the labor of love myth and the ways that it's used by employers as a trap to undervalue workers. The book was originally published in 2020 and then re-released and updated in 2021 to include the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, which exacerbated a lot of the existing problems of capitalism and labor exploitation. Our conversation mostly focuses on the sixth chapter of Work Won't Love You Back, entitled My Studio is the World, which focuses on the pursuit of art within commerce, both historically and currently. So yeah, I just want to thank you so much for being here because I feel like I was actually having some trouble writing questions for you because I was like part of my instinct was I just want you to like present the whole book to people, you know?
Yeah, unfortunately it's kind of a long book, so that would be a little tough.
But yeah, I think that any conversation about working and equity in America has to start off with a discussion about the American dream and our supposed meritocracy.
Yeah.
Could you give me your own thoughts about the veracity of those ideas and the effects that they have had on our social structure and public discourse?
Yeah, I mean, I think the American dream is sort of an exaggerated version of like the story that capitalism tells everyone, right? So it's like, essentially, when I spend time outside of the US, people will sometimes be like, but isn't that just an American problem? And I was like, oh, no, we've exported it. But it didn't begin with us either. The idea that like, we will, and particularly in the US, right, the idea that we will achieve happiness via material success, right? That we can work hard at anything and then we will succeed at anything and then we will be able to, you know, have a nice house and a nice whatever. And like, I'm talking to you from my friend's house, which is much nicer than where I live. But they are also a couple who both have employment in academia, so they make more money than me. So I use myself as an example of this, right? Like, I am a successful author. By the numbers, Work Won't Love You Back has sold enough to be considered a success. It has earned out well over its advance. It is being translated into several languages. Like, it's a successful book. I still live in a one-bedroom apartment that I rent, you know? I paid off my student loans going on 3 years ago. You know what I mean? I grew up like the daughter of the petty bourgeois, right? My grandparents were literal Jewish deli owners. My dad moved from that to owning sort of small family restaurants and then a bicycle shop. I didn't grow up poor. I didn't grow up rich. I grew up solidly middle class. My family owned a home. I still don't. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is, and I am successful. Right. Right. Like that again, like by like the publishing industry's metrics, I am a successful author. Right. So like there's just like the material fact that it's a lie at this point that if you are successful, particularly in writing, right, since we're talking about writing, that doesn't mean you're going to have money or stability or whatever. I've been freelance for most of the last 10 years. Actually, really most of the last 12 years, but I had like a one-year job in there that was a sort of fellowship position. So, right, I've done what I wanted to do. I've become an author. I've written books. People seem to like them. That's great. I am not, in fact, stable and only sometimes happy. and this dream, right, this idea that you can sort of come from anywhere to do this and you will succeed is also belied by the fact that like I had opportunities that a lot of people don't have, right? I was raised by a father who had gone to an Ivy League university, and he still, well, he's no longer with us, but he clowned me up until his death about not having gotten into as fancy a school as he did, despite his, he would say, being smarter than him. Right, I was raised by parents who were like really aggressively into having a genius baby, and so they taught me to read when I was really little and all of this stuff. They were helicopter parents before the term was invented. I went to good schools. I mean, mostly I'm a product of Massachusetts public schools, which are great public schools. Woohoo. Shout out to the Massachusetts Teachers Association. And, you know, and I'm white and I'm straight and I pass as sort of a normal cisgender female. And I went to a good school and I got out and I still flailed for, you know, 8 years before I finally sort of found my footing in journalism and got somewhere. But like, I am often in a room full of people who work in media, the person who's gone to the least fancy school, the person whose family has the least amount of money, the person who has the most debt, or had the most debt since I'm now debt-free, woo. Right, the person with the fewest advantages, the person who doesn't own their home. And again, I'm successful. So the reality is that like the industry that I work in is full of people who are second and third generation Harvard students who, you know, whose parents could buy them an apartment in New York in order to take an internship unpaid at the New Yorker and get into this field. This is why, you know, the media is currently obsessed with what's going on at Harvard and UPenn and whatever, right? This like, because that's where everybody went and that's where everybody came from. And like, no offense to anybody at the Ivies. I, again, didn't go to any of them, but I've been invited to speak at a lot of them. So, you know, I really love that for me. so this thing, right, that like, I am sort of a solidly middle of the road person. I think I made exactly the American median income this year. As I just, you know, keep track of my money. I am not able to buy a house. I am not able to do any of these things as a successful person. And also, I had a leg up that most people in this country don't have. So, you know, just as an actual fact, it's a lie. But what does it tell you? What is the usefulness of that lie to your boss, to the people who own the house you rent, to the people who, you know, run the elite university that you're in debt for 20 years, right? That is a very useful lie because it keeps you working really hard. It keeps you thinking that everything that goes wrong is your fault. And it keeps you, you know, cheerily paying rent and paying your student loans off, right? And, you know, we're in this moment right now where people are sort of constantly going like, there's so much money to be handed to fight wars in places that are not here, but we can't forgive student loans. That's like actually America's values, right? Is weapons of war and not free education.
Well, yeah, that's something I've been like thinking about a lot is just our general incentivization structure of like who gets money and what we value as seen through what we actually pay for, you know?
Yeah.
Military being like at the top of the list of
like literally.
Yeah. And you also bring up a really good point of what I would call sort of like famous poor, you know, which is like
and I'm not poor, but you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But like considering the level of success you have achieved, especially in contrast to the level of success most people in your field would achieve.
Yeah.
Like I think about when Hunter S. Thompson published Hell's Angels, when it became a bestseller.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In his letters, he was like constantly writing about like how he had seen no money from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in all these bookstores.
Yeah.
And he's like constantly called out for being a success, but he has no money.
Right, you know? Right. And you know, and this is such a thing. So I was watching the Wham documentary that's on Netflix, which, by the way, is the greatest thing if you just need to like have your heart warmed, because George Michael and Andrew, what's his name, are just adorable. Nice. But there's a bit, right, where they sign their first record deal and they're like 18 years old. These two, you know, goofballs who are just like best friends and decide to start making music together. They sign this record deal that they get basically nothing. And suddenly they're the biggest group in the world. And like this goes on, like George Michael ends up suing his record label later for control over this stuff. Like we've seen this, you know, it's not an unfamiliar story with these incredibly huge stars who basically got sucked into crappy contracts when they were children. And sure, they get rich eventually, but like even then, somebody is making so much more money than them. And I'm doing these hand gestures that nobody listening to the podcast can hear. that like somebody made like exponentially more money than them off of their work, right? Like my publisher makes more money off my book than I do. That's just a right. fact of publishing, right? They give you the advance, which is a bet to some degree on the book being a success. But like, ironically, if your book is a success, you make like often less of the profits. Like if I happen to get like a good advance and my next book is a flop, I will have made more money off my book than my publisher did. But if my book is a success, my publisher makes more money off of it than I do. You know, like these are just like the weird things about these industries that are often, you know, hidden behind the scenes. And I remember like several years ago, Fox News did the thing that they like to do to left-wing writers, which is got really mad about a tweet that I had and like broadcast it everywhere. So I was getting all these like hate comments. And like one of them was like, why don't you take all these immigrants into like your big house? And I was like, oh, honey, I live in a one-bedroom apartment. You know, like, I wish I had a big house. I would take some people in. I can't afford to, you know. It was just like this idea, right, that like, I have heard of this person. So therefore, they are like super successful and have all these things. And like, the reality is that we are, you know, the picket sign that the New Yorker staff used when they were on strike a few years ago was like, we can't eat prestige, right? Like,
right.
You know, and the reality of the way that this thing is structured is that like prestige circulates around a small group of people who already have the whole eating part covered.
Right. And there's also the discrepancy between stability, like you were saying, if your next book is a flop.
Yeah.
But
I got to find like a new career.
And you've invested all that time in there. You didn't get paid for the time putting into that. Like, whereas in other industries in more secure, and even in the arts, people who are in sort of the business end of the arts have a more secure income that is not reliant on the success of the product.
Yeah. Well, right. The interesting thing, right, is my first book, I got quite a small advance. And I had some fellowship money and some hustles and, at the time a partner who could pay half the rent. The second book, that book was successful for what it was. So I got a bigger advance for the second book. The second book is Work Won't Love You Back. That's been quite successful. I got a bigger advance for the next book, which, you know, we'll see next year, whether it's a flop or not. If that's a flop, then I go back down that ladder of whatever. And because Work Won't Love You Back was a success, even if the next one is a flop, I can probably still get like an all right advance, but it won't be as much. You know, you'll sort of move back down the list.
Right.
I'm probably not completely screwed if the next book is a flop because like the one before that was good. Well, good has nothing to do with being a flop, which is a whole other thing. Right. Lots of wonderful things are flops. The ability to do the thing has nothing to do with how much work it takes to do the thing. It has everything to do with like how bankable you are.
How do you feel about the ways that people are incentivized towards safety when it comes to work?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point because, like, actually I was going to say this before, is that, like, you know, I made some choices in my career based on the fact that I didn't want to have children. Mm-hmm. So it was easier for me to say, okay, I'm going to be a writer, which means that I'm living on these sort of gambles, right? Roll of the dice, this book succeeds, this book fails. Freelance journalism, it's up and down, publications crash all the time, which is another thing in journalism that makes like freelancing in some ways more stable than getting a job. But I did not sort of end up on the editor track, which ends up really gendered. Like a lot of women end up the editors at these publications polishing the writing of a lot of men because they are the ones who need to have a stable job because they want to have kids and they're going to be expected to be the parent who stays home and takes time off and maternity leave is really helpful and all of these things, right? Family leave, which I don't have. I don't have paid sick days. If I don't work today, I just have to do it again tomorrow. I have to do twice as much tomorrow, right? So that sort of specific thing that I was like, okay, well, if I'm not going to have another human being dependent on me, I can make the decision to make these gambles in a different way than people who have children, people who have adult dependents, people who have all sorts of caring responsibilities, have a different set of options, even given the same sort of level of privilege, say, that predispose certain people towards wanting the secure job. And others towards being like, screw it, I'll take the risk. There's a lot of good reasons to get a real job, not the least because we're in the U.S., health insurance, right?
Right.
It's easier to not do that in countries that have universal health care. I have friends in England who are artists of various types, and like one thing that just makes it a lot easier is like government's going to cover your health care wherever you work, if you work.
Right.
That kind of a safety net makes it more possible to do art. Whereas here, it's like, all right, I got to pay bills. If you have more debt, right, if you have more student debt than I did, and you're still paying it off, again, pushes you towards a secure job, right? All of these things that mitigate against the kind of risky lifestyle, once again, that we have sort of built into careers in the arts and the creative fields, partly because of this story that these fields are their own rewards. So
right.
I, you know, take the risk to be a writer because in some ways being a writer is its own reward. And that is true and it's also crap, right?
right?
I both love it and hate it. And it's also entirely possible to fund it in an entirely different way. Which is why it was interesting to profile an Irish artist for my arts chapter, right? Because like arts funding and all of that in Ireland is just very, very different than in the US. And so, you know, to think about the question of sort of safety and security. And again, like the safety and security doesn't mean crap. Like companies can fire you pretty much any time for any reason. In the US, except for the state of Montana, we're all at-will employees unless we have a specific contract because you're a very fancy person, tenure or union protections. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, you can get a job at the most successful publication. I've already mentioned the New Yorker. So, right, I could get hired as a staff writer at the New Yorker, which, by the way, is not actually a staff position. It is still a freelance position. You know, and then they could fire me 2 days later. They could decide that they don't like my position on various number of things that I say that a lot of people don't like, and fire me the next day. There are publications that, you know, go out of business. I have a friend right now who is unemployed, having had a very good job at a publication that just went poof because the hedge fund jerks who owned it decided that they didn't want it anymore, that it was not making profits because, spoiler alert, like nobody's really figured out how to make money off of internet media.
One of the main drives over the past few years that has been, for me, has been to make a case for the value of art, because I feel like in the face of how hard it is to make a living at art, like I'm trying to just like advance the idea that it has value and that we should be valuing it, especially monetarily. In particular, I also want to encourage like everyone to engage in the art, the creation of art, because I think it's a healthy and human need.
Yes.
And you take aim at the lone artist paradigm in Work Won't Love You Back, which seems to have a somewhat similar result, what are your personal feelings about the role of art in people's lives, both as like audience members and as creators?
Yeah, I think so. Years ago, I did a panel with my friend Molly Crabapple and Ben Davis, who's an art critic, that we called In Defense of Bad Art. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about was like, Ben had written this wonderful book about called 9.5 Theses on Art in Class. And we wanted to talk about this idea that like art is only for like a special group of people. And I actually think one of the things that I wanted to talk about was that like we actually have to fund like the creation of art, not the sale of art. Right, because most of what we're talking about, I'm talking about book sales, whatever, right? We're talking about the sale of paintings, if you make paintings or something like that, right? Most people who make a living sell record sales, if you're George Michael, you know, most people who make a living at art make a living from selling their art in one way or another. That has very little to do, as I already said, with how much it costs to create that art. Right. If you are, you know, a super famous artist like Jeff Koons, you not only make enough money to fund your own very nice living, but also to have a stable of employees that don't get any credit on anything that you do. Right. That's also mentioned in the book. Right. Because I talked to somebody who was one of those people. The way that we could fund art is something more like what happens in other countries that I have some experience in, like Ireland and England, where like there are arts councils, there are like more public funding that you can apply to make your art. You still have to, you know, prove that your art's going to be good, make an argument that your art's going to be good. But like I have worked with artists in Ireland and in England who have gotten grants for things that like I'm just like, I don't know how you would get this funded in the US unless like some private, you know, whatever philanthropy decided that like they really wanted to do whatever it is. There's just like the availability of money to make your thing, which doesn't require you to like produce a product at the end that is saleable. So to think about what a society that valued the production of art would look like, it would be one where everybody has free time and enough money that their needs are met so that you can do whatever your art practice is, whether it is making big, beautiful sculptures in your neighborhood that everybody gets to look at or gluing macaroni to a plate. Like whatever it is you might do in your spare time, if you had more spare time, more people could do it. Which also means I think we'd get a lot more good art, right? Because there are all sorts of people who could be making good art who aren't because they're working, you know, 80 hours a week in two restaurant jobs. The value of making art itself, I think, is something that's been really interesting since the inception of sort of what we're now calling AI, but is like large language models particularly, right? Or whatever the equivalent is for like making illustrations. And Molly has written and spoken extensively about this, so I just end up quoting her a lot. But like, these are things that people do on some level because we do love them, right? And the fact that like we still don't have a robot that can clean toilets, but we have robots that can ostensibly write poetry. The poetry sucks, but like whatever, right? That like the Writers Guild of America strike and the SAG Screen Actors Guild strike this year were about, in part, the potential to be replaced by algorithms. I don't think that an algorithm anytime soon is going to be able to write my next book. What it can do is like recycle my last book, right? Because it scrapes from the internet. The illustration ones are basically mashing up the work of already existing artists from work that they've already done. But nonetheless, that we are putting, that the jerks who own a few tech companies are putting all of this money into creating robots who can do some of the few things that people really love doing that are jobs for a vanishingly small number of people already. Like, what does that tell you about society, right? That, like, we don't think of art as, like, this essentially human activity that we all can do in some way. We think of it as a source of profits. Mm-hmm. And if you have an algorithm that can do it, then you don't have to pay me or an illustrator, right? Or an actor. If you can just like CGI, you know, their face, then you no longer have to pay Tom Cruise. Right? That like, instead of thinking of these things as like social cultural activities that are meaningful because humans are social creatures that like to communicate with each other and we have all these messy emotions that we have to deal with, we're solely thinking of them as productive of profit. And that is just like deeply weird and screwed up, right? Because this world is so broken. And there are so many things that like it would be really cool if robots could do. Like I saw somebody's like tweet the other day that was like, do we have a robot that can pick plastic out of the Atlantic Ocean yet? Or are they, do all the robots have to be poets? You know, it's like, yeah. Right? When you think of this, it's just like, what the hell is wrong with this world? That this is where like technology is going. And that's of course because like the people who are creating the technology are not democratically accountable to anyone, and they're just doing what will save them money or what will make them money.
It also, I guess, bothers me on the level of like when I see people talking about trying to get more creativity in the workplace. Like we need creative workers who are going to like solve these creative problems.
Right.
And it's like, I don't know. I just have a lot of like triggers around that.
Yeah. Well, right. Because like you're saying to me that like we value this skill, but only if like it makes, you know, we're going to apply creativity to like how to fire people, right? Like, you know, like one of the number one things that people come out of like Harvard and Yale, to go back to beating on the Ivies for a minute, to go do is to be like a management consultant, which basically a big part of your job is still telling businesses that they need to fire some people in order to make more money. Mm-hmm. That's what they're teaching you to do. These companies, the people with science degrees are now being recruited to go like work in finance, to write algorithms for slightly faster high speed trading, which is just like nuts. Like this adds no value to the world. Zero. Mm-hmm. Absolutely none. High speed trading only is gambling.
Right.
There is literally no need to do that at the speed. Like if the argument for finance is that it exists to efficiently allocate resources to capitalist enterprise in a system that's something, something, whatever. There's no need to do that at the speed of algorithm that is faster than you and I can think, right?
Right.
If it's about allocating resources, like it just, the only reason to do that is to be a tiny bit faster than the next guy to get to the thing beforehand. Mm-hmm. Like it's only useful for trying to make more money out of existing money. That use of creativity, the place that it goes, the money that it is used to make. Whereas again, like even if we want to talk about like creative problem solving, because like the world is on fire, again, like right, why do we not have a robot picking plastic out of the Atlantic Ocean? I don't have a robot that can walk this dog for me, which is fine because right. I love this dog. Yeah, I do. the things that are like deeply, deeply human are the things that we're trying to automate away, because the points at which there are humans in the production cycle are also the points at which humans can say, no, screw you, pay me more, I refuse to work under these conditions, I'm gonna set it all on fire.
Much of your chapter on art focuses on printmaking artist Kate O'Shea, which mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier, lives in Ireland.
Yes.
And one of her quotes that really struck me was that there's no way that I could have justified becoming an artist if it involved the kind of money it involves in America.
Right.
And we touched on this a little bit, but the discrepancy between funding of the arts in U.S. versus elsewhere yeah. has come up in a lot of my other interviews mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And I just want you, like, I just want to ask, like, what do you think that does? What does that mean for artists in America, and yeah. what do you think it does to the art?
Well, and one of the things that, you know, it's interesting because it starts actually with education funding, that, like, she could go to art school in Ireland and not end up $100,000 in debt. Mm-hmm. And then it's the going out into the world and actually being able to get funding to do art and to make these wonderful installations that she makes and these, you know, prints and all the different things that she makes. And like being an installation artist means like almost sort of inherently like you don't have anything to sell. You are creating an experience in this building, like the one that she did in this bank. You don't have a product to sell. Like, she can sell prints and things like that, but like most of what she likes to do as her art practice is to like create a space that is a social experience. Americans are like, no. Like, the only point of going to art school is so you can sell things, right? My sister went to art school. My sister's a photographer. Mostly she's a wedding photographer because that's what pays the bills. Occasionally she does other stuff. But mostly she doesn't make like art photography nearly at all. She just does whatever. And she talks about it as like, you know, I learned a trade, which is great. She right. mostly likes her job. I mean, sometimes weddings are really annoying to photograph, but like, you know, mostly she's doing well. She's, you know, able to pay her bills, and she and her business partner have been working together for, God, I don't even know how long now. And that's fine. Right. But, if she had come out of an American art school with the amount of student debt that people come out of American art school with and said, I want to take photographs, but only in order to make like installations somewhere that people have to experience, how would she pay the bills? That's just not a thing. So, you know, thinking about this question of like, nowhere in the world funds art to the degree that I think it should be funded to, right? Like, the artists that I know in Ireland and England are stressed. And Carrie Guinan, who's also mentioned in that chapter, talking about starting a union for artists, they've actually have started a union for artists. It's called Praxis. And they have been, one of the things they've been arguing, organizing around since the pandemic, is a basic income for artists. And they're working on it and have gotten some government buy-in on it. But like, it still doesn't like fully exist. And even then, like the questions of like, well, then who qualifies as an artist and how do you get to get that? Right, you sort of have to do the thing in order to be able to do the thing, which right. elsewhere in the book I talk about as hope labor, right? Mm-hmm. You have to sort of write for free in order for somebody to eventually write to pay you, even if that's just like writing a book proposal for the book that eventually you will get paid to write. Like, a book proposal is like 30,000 words. Like, that's, you know, there are books that long. Right. But you are doing all of that before anybody gives you any money. And, you know, I know people who have written book proposals that they haven't sold. That is just like, well, you know, I've written proposals not for books, but for other things that haven't sold. That is just like, I just did a bunch of work and it just went nowhere. So like, what, again, would it look like to really securely fund the arts? Some of that is like, you know, I feel like we need a basic income for everyone, because then you could actually have the time and the ability to like figure out that you want to be an artist, to then get better at the thing. One of the things that I was really fascinated by in researching for that chapter, which was like, in a lot of ways it was my favorite one to do because it was the thing that I knew the least about. Like, I had an idea about artists, and I had an idea of this idea of the magical special genius who just like, you know, it's the Van Gogh story, right? He's just like so right. tormented that he cuts off his own ear. But also he just has to create, and that's the, you know. So I had an idea about that story, but then in researching, I learned all of these different ways that it plays out. And also just found that very few people had written about the actual work of making art, that there was just really very little literature to find. So instead I went down rabbit holes of reading like the history of the New Deal. And one of the things that I learned was that, like, you know, we know about sort of the New Deal funding murals and photographs and those, you know, beautiful Dust Bowl photos and giant paintings and everything, but they also funded community art centers that anybody could go to and take a class or just like have studio space, so that literally you could make it easier for people to make art, not just experience like seeing other people's art, right? Which is important on its own. But what if also going hand in hand with that, we actually valued like making art more accessible to more people, which is sort of the opposite of this lone genius magical artist idea, which is originally your question. That instead of saying, like, I'm a special person who's a writer, I think that everybody could write. And, like, the, you know, the advent of Twitter and whatever had sort of shown us that, like, a lot of people can write. A lot of people are very funny and are, you know, tweeting around their day job because they don't actually have a chance to, like, sit down and try to write a book. That there are all sorts of people who can make beautiful art that, you know, sometimes just, you know, photos on your Instagram or whatever, right? Like, there is a way that these terrible social media companies are capitalizing on this thing about us, which is that, like, we are creative creatures that like to make things and we like to share them with each other. And if given half a chance, we'll do that without getting paid. If we have, like, any sort of access to the means of production, right, the means of art production, even though it feels very funny at this point of Elon Musk's career to call Twitter the means of anything production other than, like, whatever. But you know what I mean? That there's this idea that a special person is an artist, and they will create whether or not they are paid. That is just that they have to do it because that is what they are. As opposed to the rest of us who just, you know, should go to work. And again, it's sort of, it's totally belied by, like, the actual material conditions of art production, but also just by, like, opening the internet at random and seeing all of the fun, cool things that people who have crappy day jobs that they hate are producing and sharing just for the fun of it. And what would it look like for these, A, for these social media companies to not be owned by the worst people in the world, and I mean that very literally, thanks Elon. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is Twitter, which, like, millions of people use to communicate and joke and tell stories and whatever, is literally owned by, like, the descendant of South African apartheid emerald miners, who is encouraging, like, the most racist garbage. You know, it's just like, what?
Yeah.
And that's because we've privatized all of these things. And so he can do it.
And one thing that I feel like came up in my head while you were talking is, like, the that I've been thinking about a lot as well is the discrepancy between how long it takes to make something and the amount of time that people think that it takes to make something or the amount of time that it takes to, like imbibe artwork, you know?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes when it, like, I've made a, the last project I put out, I worked on for 14 years.
Wow.
And,
And, like, what was it? Wait.
It's called Weird Music.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not, like, totally done, but I put it out as, like, an album and a short video.
Okay.
And as I was looking at the video, I was like, do people know that, like, every 2 minutes of this is, like, probably
a year of your
1,000 hours of work?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that registers for anybody. And, and I think it goes to, like your inability to find evidence of, like, what art looks like as a practice, as, like, the working on art.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, and even book proposals of 30,000 words, that's, like, writing those words.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
The actual physical writing.
Right. And even beyond that, like, right, like, so I've got a book that's coming out sometime in the fall. And I spent, I mean, frankly, it's about grief, and I took, like, 3 years just getting to the emotional place where I could write it. And then it took me a couple months to write a book proposal. And some of this time, like, I'm obviously doing other work because I have to eat. A couple months to write a book proposal, a month or so of, like, negotiations with the existing publisher who wanted to buy it, a little bit longer to wait to get the money. In there, I'm already doing the research and reading because, like, already to write the proposal, you've started doing the research and the reporting. Then another year of just sort of research and reporting. And then over the summer, I just cleared my schedule entirely, and the only thing I did was write the book. So I basically, like, wrote a draft in 3 months. But that doesn't even encompass how much I had done beforehand to be able to write, you know, 1,500 words a day over the summer. And I write long, which is an annoying characteristic that most of my editors would like to cure me of, particularly when I'm writing for, you know, like, space-delimited things like magazines. Right. But But also my editor on this book was like, okay, we need to cut a lot of this. And I was like, Clive, I worked so hard. And that also you won't see, right? Like I actually have a spreadsheet because my editor and I were negotiating back and forth on this. So I've literally got a spreadsheet about like the word counts that like the word counts that I turned this in at, and then the word count that we cut it down to in the second one and the third one, it was like, you know. And so I can see how many of my words like ended up on the scrap bin floor. And also while you're cutting, you're also rewriting and, you know. So there's like, there is a 160,000 word version of this book that existed that then like took many, many hours of my and my editor's time to winnow it down to something that's actually hopefully good. And then right now it's in the hands of a copy editor whose name will be basically nowhere on the thing except in my acknowledgments because I'm not a jerk. The copy editors are mostly freelance. And then it will come back to me, and then it will go to a proofreader. And I've also bullied some friends into reading sections of it to give me notes because they love me. And, you know, convincing other writers to do free labor for you is part of the whole situation. And all of that will be invisible when you buy a book that is, you know, 300 and something pages, right? And a lot of that's notes. All of that work, all of those other people's work, right? My editor's name does not go on the cover of the book. Again, like his name will only be, it's only in the, you know, the sales announcement and in my acknowledgments. And in the, you know, internal sales meeting, if the book's a flop and everybody's like, Clive, how dare you? How did you spend this much money on this book that no one wants to read? Right? You know, I might get him in trouble if the book doesn't sell. But, again, right, there's so much labor that goes into this product that takes somebody, say, 8 hours to read the whole book, right? Mm-hmm. It's a conservative estimate. I read fast and write long, so, you know, I'm annoying that way. Mm-hmm. And, like, a friend of mine years ago who was teaching a class on book publishing at the New School had me and somebody else come in to talk about our books. And one of the things she said at the beginning of the class was, like, you know, this is the thing in your life that you've worked the hardest on, and it's the thing that the fewest people will read. And I was like, oh, my heart. But it's true, right? Like the other thing that happens when you put a book out in the world is you do a bunch of interviews and you write some pieces related to it and you do a whole bunch of things that like probably people, at least when you read a nonfiction book, right? That probably people who will never read my book are listening to this, right? I don't know how many of your listeners will have already read it. I don't know how many of them will pick it up as a result of this conversation. No idea. And that's cool because some of those people get to hear me talk who would never read that whole book and maybe get something out of it or maybe think I'm just blathering. But that is sort of part of the thing that like there is a ripple effect from the actual book that you don't have to have read the book for it to have made an influence, had an influence somewhere. So like there are all of these ways that this thing that you spent so much of your life on will like brush up against people's lives in like tiny little ways, again, if you're lucky, that they will never even think about how many hours of my life I spent on this thing. The way that there's just like hours and years and decades of invisible labor going into these things. That is devalued because we only care about the commodity. And this is like the classical thing that Marx wrote about is like the commodity fetish, right? That like we relate to the world through objects, through my phone, through this laptop, through a cup, without any sense of who made it. Right. And that when we have to think about who made it and how it was made and the labor that went into that, it makes us like deeply uncomfortable actually. But that like unveiling the commodity in these ways is really crucial for sort of understanding the world that we live in. So like a lot of people know now that like smartphones are made in probably China, in probably terrible conditions. The story about the Foxconn factory suicides went around. People are probably aware that like the rare minerals that these things rely on are mined in Congo, probably by children. And then it's shipped across the world, and maybe it was on a ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal, and so then we learned about, you know, that part of the logistics practice. And, like, these things are really fascinating, but most of the time when you pick up your phone, you don't think about them.
Right.
You're just like, gotta answer my email. Right. Most of the time when I go into the kitchen and make a cup of tea, I do not think about the people who farmed the tea, nor the people who made the cup, or where it came from. But that's also true of art. And this is what like John Berger talked about as mystification, right? We don't think about the process of making art. And one of the stories that he tells in Ways of Seeing that I really loved was of the painter Frans Hals, who ended up in a poorhouse and did this beautiful painting of like the sort of trustees of the poorhouse. And so there's this entire social relation happening in this painting that like most people are just like, oh, look at that lovely painting, and don't think like, oh, this was actually like an old man whose art, despite the fact that we are still looking at it however many years later, was not valued enough in his lifetime for him to be able to like stay in his home. And now he's painting this, you know, the reason we have so many portraits of kings and queens is not because everybody thought the kings and queens were so beautiful. It's because the kings and queens paid for it.
Right.
Right. So like all of these histories are missing from how we relate to the thing, whether the thing is my book or Frans Hals' painting or this plastic cup from wherever. Does it say where it was made? I've got too much water in it to look at the bottom.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.